Major Han, Reel 3. I think you were saying that at Aldershot you got issued with the Morris rather than the Lanchester. How did the two compare?
Was much smaller and faster. Same armament, really, but instead of Vickers, we had a Remington, and instead of a 25, we had the Boys' rifle, which was 25. It was an open-topped turret, which you could traverse by having a grip and a handle, and you pull the grip, and you can swing it to whichever. And pull it around
By hand,
by hand.
how do you traverse the turrets on the Lanchester then? What was it? But
Wheel.
cranking a handle.
Cranking the handle. But this one, you just release the catch and take it to any hole where you release the catch. And that was open. It had a number 9 set radio. And was not a heavy vehicle at all. The tyres were sort of run track, actually, like a silver type. We've never had
Solid tyres.
those before. Not solid as such, but they had this sort of a run track thing. Sort of inside was silver, but they were still, and it was better strong than the Lanchester.
Do you think it was a better vehicle?
Oh, yes, it was. You could maneuver it more. I mean, it was half the size and half the height, and it was to say much faster.
What about the noise level of
Oh, the engine
sound?
was quieter than the much quieter than the Lanchester.
And speed, was it?
Oh, you could get quite a good speed to that. I think you get 40, 45, somewhere in the middle, but not cross country.
No, well, I mean, was the cross-country performance as good in terms of
Not
getting
really.
across
It would get
obstacles?
stuck very easily
The
in
Morris
stuff.
would.
Yes, as would the Manchester, really, I think. We didn't use it much cross country.
And what about the armament? Did you think it was an improvement to give up the Vickers and get a
Well,
Bren and the
same caliber
Boys?
things.
Yes.
The Boys' rifle, we were told, would destroy a German tank, an enemy tank. It just bounced off. Any armament we had then was pathetic. The guns, as you know already, the tanks or armored cars, they were pretty useless.
Well, what about the Bren gun?
The Bren gun was good, for as accurate and for against infantry, it was ideal. Nothing wrong with the Bren.
But you wouldn't be able to fire quite so sustained burst, would you?
Well, you
Because
had
you.
your magazine, which was very easy to
Yes.
change. It was a 13 in the magazine,
I think
I
it
think,
was usually about
28.
28, 30, yes.
Well, you'd knock that off and put another one in. You'd never want to fire more than a complete magazine in one go, really. It would be in short bursts anyway.
So you didn't miss having a belt fed?
No. I think probably the Bren was better from that point, but sometimes you just get, with a belt-fed one, you just get a jam,
Oh,
and
yes.
it's more difficult then to free it than it
So
would be a magazine.
it'd be better, easier to clear a stoppage on the Bren than
As
on
fine than on
the Vickers.
the Vickers, yeah.
And you wouldn't need a water jacket with the Bren, presumably.
No.
And what about comfort inside the vehicle?
Much the
Was
same as the other.
much the same
Seats
as
on
other?
the floor
Yes.
and the drivers. Wasn't too bad for space on the floor. You could lean against one side and stretch your legs out, and sort of get a little bit of comfort, but there's nothing, it won't be for comfort anyway.
No luxuries.
No luxuries at all.
But was there room for you to be able to pack your kit in, if you were going into
Oh, they
the
had bins all around that you
field?
could use to go into, yes.
And could you carry water, rations, other
Oh,
things
yes,
in
you
there?
carried your always, when we were on active service, then we carried rations for the four men, or whatever the crew was, for 3 days, and the water for 3 days.
Presumably that would also go for exercises, or...
Yes.
What sort of... how often would the thing need refuelling? What sort of mileage should you get out of it before it needed a refill?
Honestly, I couldn't... I know it would go a long, long way. It wasn't a problem. They were quite economical, I think.
The Morris?
The Morris, yes.
Better than the Lanchester?
Oh, yes. The Lanchester would drink better.
And anything you remember about the comparative reliability of the...
The Morris is very reliable. Yeah, I can't recall a breakdown on the Morris.
What about driving it? Was it...
Very easy to drive. Much lighter. Just normal, like a car, gearbox. Nothing particularly heavy about it at all.
And visibility, being able to see out of it?
Well, the driver's view was just about that much. The operator had none, and just the commander and gunner had their head out of the turret because it was a big...
An open turret. Did you have any way of keeping the rain out if it started pouring?
No, not really.
No, you didn't have a sort of canvas cover.
Well, that was
cover.
You could probably use it. Ah. I mean, if you were stationary, then you could put the canopy over it. But normally, certainly on active service, you'd have to do that. You'd be blind anyway.
So you just had to get wet.
You'd just got wet.
Yeah. The wet weather training program is often concerned with getting wet. And 1938, you're in Aldershot. This is the time when the war is drawing closer.
I was sent to Bobbington on a Wireless Instructor's course.
Ah.
And I was promoted to corporal.
What was the Wireless Instructor's course like?
It was a 3-month course. And you basically did... what you did in your original training, really.
Yes.
But then you were given different tests and then you had to teach. And you were teaching your own class so that you could pass on the information to other people in your regiment.
So you were going to be a regimental instructor in wireless.
That's right, yes.
Signalling. Was this mainly radio by this time, or did they also carry on with helio and flags and lamps?
Still did the flag drill and all that, so I think that's an instructor's course.
They did?
Yes.
And I forgot to ask you if the Morris had the same wireless system as the...
They had a number 9 set, was a good set.
Better than the...
I think it was better.
What way?
You still got the crackling and that sort of thing, but yes. It had a power unit, a foot. 18 inches,
yes.
And then you had your sending and receiving units, and they were stacked nicely in quite compact. And that was good, that the density farms came out. No problems.
What sort of range would that give you?
I think about 12.
12 miles?
Yeah, I think you might have got 15, but I don't think you really tried it, because normally within the squadron you were... You were never that far away.
I was going to ask, when you went out as a troop to do a reconnaissance on an exercise, how far would the interval be between cars, you know, if you were deployed?
It depended on the countryside. Certainly in England, you were one up, and round the bend would be another one, and that's how you could do it.
Were you normally roughly in a sort of triangular formation?
No, normally we had to be on the same road.
Ah, I see.
Lots of things.
So you're in a column, essentially.
A column, or that, unless there happened to be a track or something which was running
parallel.
And that depended on the map. You play it according to...
Did you, as a matter of principle, always keep a line, within sight of each other?
Yes, yeah. If it was a long straight road, of course, you would then drop back quite a bit. But still... be available in case the cover was wanted.
Maintain visual contact.
That's right.
Yeah.
A lot depended on the terrain and how you move.
So roughly how you know, so you really wouldn't have to use the capacity for 12 miles, would you, if you were?
No,
because you would report back to squadron and squadron back to regiment.
Back to regiment, you see. Mm. So really, over a squadron area might be 12 miles across, but the squad leader would be in the centre.
Yeah.
They'd be 6 miles out and 6 miles out. Probably a mile back.
So it would be quite easy to keep
keeping
track.
Yeah, we never lost. Mm. I can't remember the radio contact.
Did you have a troop net or a squadron net or regimental net?
You had a squadron net.
Yes. How many stations did you have on that? A dozen stations?
A dozen, yeah. Mm. There might have been one for the transport.
Yeah, yes.
Near enough a dozen.
Near enough dozen. That, it seems to me that would require an exceptionally rigorous radio discipline to keep a net that many.
Yes, yes. It was basically the troop leaders would be the main ones to do the talking, and one of the other armoured cars would come in if necessary, if that happened to be. But mainly it was troop leaders who did most of it.
So if you had that, then you'd have sort of four primary stations, wouldn't you, on the net, the HQ and the
three
troop leaders. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm. But the others could come in if
they had something important.
Yeah. Mm. But they wouldn't have to acknowledge any orders.
Yes.
You know, they'd go to the three troop leaders and they would acknowledge, you see, and they'd be able to troop leader to make sure that his own troop was got.
He'd call up the others and ask them.
Mm.
Mm. Yeah. So you're at Bovingdon for 3 months, and presumably this was a course affecting everyone in the armoured corps, was it?
What do you mean?
The radio.
Oh, yeah, the instructor's course.
Yes.
Yeah, each regiment's an NCO army.
Yeah.
And from all the different companies that you should be having.
And were you taught by the Royal Signals there or by other armoured signalers?
They were. Let me think. I think they were regimental signalers. Because it was more. By then, there had been others. And they were mainly people who were teaching you how to instruct.
Yes.
So it wasn't necessary for the whole course anymore.
So, presumably, when you got back to Aldershot, you were doing this job of running a.
Yes, I started to
run a signal school.
Yeah, and then I became. I was quickly promoted then to a sergeant. Mm. And I became the squad leader's operator.
What happened before you could get promoted? Because you had several promotions, hadn't you? From Lance Corporal, then Corporal, and then Sergeant. Were there any formal tests or a selection board or anything like that?
Depending on how your work was progressing, you know, if you were good at your job, or you showed other as an NCO, and all those sort of different qualities, then it'd be noted, and then when it came up for promotions, your name was there.
You got recommended.
Yes. Mm. And so I was then a sergeant with 2 years' service, I think.
Very rapid promotion indeed.
Prepared, and as I say, it was still the chaps who were Lance Corporals, 10 years' service before I joined. You know. Mm. But I had no problems. I got on well with them.
Did you find there were soldiers who were troopers who didn't want promotion, who were just not interested in advancement?
Well, not really. They'd have been after it because that meant more money for them. They would have taken it, but you know, they didn't have. They might be a good driver. They might have been a good operator. You know, but they had nothing else to offer. You know, they looked, say, for leadership. And other qualities, you know, because you are always under observation, and of course, if you're doing your job or whatever, you're noticed. Mm. And you get some of the first class at their jobs, but they couldn't handle men or
Mm. I was saying that 1938 was getting towards the end of the war, getting towards the end of the peace, towards the war. Can you remember when it was you first thought that it was likely there was going to be another war in Europe?
Well, there was sort of early, when they were talking about sending an arrangement to for a plebiscite on the soil. Before Hitler invaded, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Sudetenland, was that called?
Sudetenland was 1938, after the Munich crisis.
That's
yes.
Right. Then we were thinking then that we might be sent there as a regiment.
To Germany or to Czechoslovakia?
Well, to supervise that they were going to have a plebiscite.
Yes.
And there was talk about us being sent there to supervise it.
Yeah.
And where exactly it was going to be, I don't know, but that was the first inclination that we thought was.
Mm.
And then it wasn't until 39, early 39, that
Early 39. Mm. Do you remember that anything in particular that happened that persuaded you that a war was on the cards?
Well, when we started digging trenches all around, I thought the general feeling, you know, when Chamberlain came back, with his peace in our town, I didn't think people were very confident then.
How was that idea received?
Well, everyone was excited about it. You know, they didn't realise what it meant. Quite honestly, nobody realised what war was really like.
Didn't you have any old soldiers from the First World War still serving?
But even so, and we hadn't seen any films as we see today, and people really, they thought it was a big adventure, but they didn't realise what war would be like.
I was going to ask you if anyone that you knew or you yourself had any idea about the way in which the war might be fought.
No, not really. The only thing we thought that we would still do our job as a concentration.
Yes.
But not realising that meant being shot at. And seeing friends killed and that sort of thing. I don't think we'd grasp that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I think if we'd seen some of the modern day films of war, then I think they might have brought it home to us, but we haven't.
Yeah.
I think the only one we'd seen in those days was H.G. Wells'
War of the Worlds, or
Shape of Things to Come.
What about New Zealand's the First World War and that sort of thing? I mean, they were weren't they?
They rarely saw anything in the First World War.
Because quite a lot of people say that when they realised the war was likely, they were thinking in terms of another spell of years and years in trenches, yes.
No, we didn't give that thought, actually. We thought of armoured cars and tanks, and never gave a thought to living in a trench as an infantryman.
And, I mean, do you think were you aware at the time of the existence of the German Panzer forces and their character?
No. We thought we would be in there and out in a couple of months and it would be over.
Oh, right, so a rapid war.
That's right.
Mm. Was the regiment up to strength at the time of the outbreak?
Well, not. Well, I think they increased in strength. I think we had about 500 men.
Yes.
Near enough at the beginning of the war. But then when the war was imminent, we got a lot of reservists called back.
Well, these time expired men, right. Who'd done their.
And they came and joined us younger force.
Yes.
And they were good. I mean, we had a jolly good mixture of really experienced, solid type people. I had a driver who came. He'd left the army and he was a civilian. He came back, he must have been getting on for 40, I should think. And there was me sort of giving them orders. But they couldn't have been better. They had a great chance.
Were they happy to be back?
Well, they didn't show, I don't suppose they were happy, but they didn't show any dissent at all.
So they're really so they just melted back in. Do you remember what you were doing when the war actually broke up? When they
yes, we were in all the shops. We were actually at that time on a Sunday. We were packing all our cars ready for war. At 11 o'clock, I think it was, we all went to our different messes and listened to Chamberlain say that we were at war with Germany. We came straight back out, finished our loading, and then that evening drove out of the barracks with all our kit and everything to different villages around Hampshire.
Froyle is in Hampshire, yes. Right. It's near Alton.
That's right. Alton was another one.
Yes.
All around that area.
Yes.
We went and found barns or farms and different troops and different things spread out there. Depends on the day that all was spent.
Do you know why you did that?
In case they came to bomb there.
So you were dispersing against air attack. Yeah, you said you're packing the armoured cars. What did you pack them with? What went into them?
You put on your camouflage nets, you roll them up. Because all your tools used to be kept in the store.
Yes.
And they weren't on the armoured car until you went out on the exercise.
They had to be issued by the quartermaster.
Yeah, and so they were all being loaded, ammunition and guns, everything was all put on. So you were then everything you needed. Your blankets were rolled and put on, and so you were ready for action.
So you went out fully operational on the first day of war?
Yeah. Until Alton, then you were in these spaces, so you were still doing training and whatnot.
Was there any change in the training at all after war had been declared?
Not really. We knew what we had to do, and it was just out the rough edges, really.
So it was still practicing recce.
Oh, yes.
You mentioned putting blankets in the cars when you were out on exercise or on operations. You know, overnight. Where did you sleep? Did you sleep in the car?
On the floor.
Not outside it.
Outside the car.
Oh, right.
By the wheels.
Yes.
Because an armoured car gets very cold.
Ah,
inside the car is very cold, and only one of you could really get into a position where you could see, because there wasn't the room. So everyone else used to sleep outside. You had a down sheet and two blankets. Mm. And that's what you the lay there, the down sheet and the blanket and then the others.
So you rolled up in your blanket.
Right. Yeah. Mm.
Did you dig in at all?
No.
You didn't dig a shell scrape or anything like that?
No. We very rarely did that, actually. I'm sure we should have done, but we didn't.
And in similar circumstances, how did you deal with feeding? Did you have...
Well, at that stage, there was a central cookhouse.
Yes.
You know, where you would come in and eat. Mm. You know, the squadron was chosen as a man to do 100 yards. And that, and so there was central cooking then. Mm. It wasn't until we got into actual active service that we...
But I mean, when that happened, when you couldn't have central cooking, did you have a sort of collective cooking per car?
Yes, per car. Yeah. You had 3 days rations on board. You had a number two cooker.
Ah, right.
And
what was a number two cooker like?
That size
of the Marantz machine.
Right.
Yes.
And a little bit deeper.
Yes.
And there's a little tank that held the petrol.
Oh, it's a petrol stove.
And
pressurised.
Yeah, and that's the trouble we used to have time to get them to go.
Yes.
Because you could use a bit of methylated spirit.
Methylated spirit on the burners, yes.
Right.
Yes.
Nobody had that sort of thing.
No.
And then it was always being sorted out. So
yep.
And one of the members of the crew was just... take whatever, whoever was doing something, if I was on the busy on the radio, the driver would do it.
So it wasn't always the same chap then. No, it was the chef of the no. So, and did everyone take their turn in doing this in the car?
Yeah. Mm. John Peter didn't.
He didn't.
He was always looked after anyway. But everybody else took the time in doing it, and there wasn't much of a choice of what you had to eat anyway.
What was in the ration packs in those days?
The main thing then was corned beef.
Yes.
Hard-packed biscuits. Mixed stew, that and the pommies. Probably a tin of cheese and some margarine, some tea and condensed milk. And that would be about it. That was certainly in France.
Yes.
When you got on the desert. I think that's my saying.
What so you were dispersed in various locations, hidden in the area around Alton in sort of North Hampshire. How long were you there before you made your next move?
Well, our next move was down to Southampton, ready to get on the boat to go to France, and that was in, about the 28th of September, I think, we went to France.
So you had about a month or so?
Yes. 3rd of September. 3rd of September war was declared.
That's right.
On the 28th, we went to France.
So you went down to Southampton, and how did you get the cars on the ship?
Well, the drivers only went with them.
Yes.
To a loading place, and I think they got lifted on by crane. I didn't see it, just the drivers went through the We went and stayed a night in tents in Southampton in one of the parks until we got on a little cross channel boat and was taken across to Sherbourne.
Was this your first trip abroad?
No, I had been to Holland before.
From Yarmouth?
Yeah.
Yes. What did you make of Cherbourg when you came ashore? Your first impressions of France?
I couldn't see much of it really, but it wasn't until we went to a bit out from Cherbourg to a big old castle called Martinbass, I think it was, just outside, and then we could have a look and see what's what. I found the French, very friendly in the little villages where we stayed. But we only stayed there a short time until our cars came.
They come in through Cherbourg as well.
That's right. Yes. And so we brought to the reservation there. And then we loaded them onto flats, railway flats. And one man got in the turret on the flats to be with it all the way up when we went near Harris. And the rest of them got into these big trucks which would hold 12 horses or 48 men.
The box cars, the famous box cars.
So, fortunately, I got onto the turret. I went through France up to Harris, standing up in the turret with them, and I could see the countryside.
So, how long did that journey take, the journey out to Arras?
Oh, probably, I wouldn't be quite sure, I'd say about 8 to 10 hours perhaps. Might have been more, but around about that time. I know I was a day up in that tower.
Yeah. And what was your job in the measure at that time? I know you were instructing on the signals call.
I was squad leader's operator.
Oh, right.
And squadron signal sergeant.
Yes. Who was the squadron leader then?
We had two. First it was Arthur Gannon.
Yeah.
And but when we went into action, it was William Brown Faden.
So So it was Arthur Gemmell at this time then on your way, when you were on your way up.
Yeah, all through the sort of period when it was
before the balloon went up.
Right.
Yeah. And what sort of man was he?
He was a nice man, very kind. He lived up in Leicestershire somewhere, he had a big farm. But a very kind type of man. He looked an old man to me, a far older sort of figure. Probably he wasn't, but I suppose